Blog Talk Radio.
The first question we ask is, who am I? Who am I?
The new champion of the world.
Voices fighting each other.
Madness.
I can't lose. I refuse to lose.
The makeup of the mind.
I met the president of Chesney. I met the president of Istanbul.
I'm going to relax, son, because I don't want my head to swell any more than it is.
They gave me a parade in Moscow. They don't even speak English over there.
I've always been interested in women. They have a magnetic force towards me.
It's been pure hell.
That was disastrous because I was too immature to be married.
It was the most horrible time of my life. Going to prison, I lost my reputation. I lost everything that I worked so hard for. The door, and then we were coming behind them with our guns, and we were robbing them. This guy could take you to the next level. He said, just trust this man. I won all the championships. I'm gonna cry because he told me what to do. To be honest, I'm a jerk sometimes, and I say things that sometimes crap.
He took me in his house. He didn't even know me.
When I first come here, I said, wow, I could rob these white guys. This will be my black brother. Like, he's just a wretched, slimy, reptilian mother. Along the way, I became a very proud father of six kids.
I'm fighting, but all of a sudden I'm getting hit. Boom, boom, pow, pow. The next thing I know, the fight is stopped. I was the ex-champion.
It's the most unbelievable thing I've ever been privileged to witness.
If I have any anger, if it's directed at anyone, it's directed at myself.
I come out of supreme confidence. I'm scared to death.
Geeks United is on the air. Happy Mother's Day, everybody.
Happy Milf Day.
Yeah. Hey, did you just say Happy Milf Day or Happy Mother's Day?
I said Happy Milf Day. Because, you know, I always think, you know, it's no secret to anyone who truly knows me. I think in a pornographic mentality. And,
yeah.
You know, when your idols are Vicky Vett and Chasey Lane growing up, you know, that's bound to happen. But yeah, happy Milf Day, no, really. Happy Mom's Day. The mother, being a mother is the hardest job in this world. Ask my mother. She had to raise a retard like me and my two other brothers. So, you know, thank God for her. We'd all be out in the street selling drugs and being pimps. So, yeah, thank God for her.
Yeah, I mean, the breastfeeding alone was torture on me back when I was a mother.
Yeah, they always said I was the Russ Meyer of my generation.
What'd you do? What have you guys done?
What have we done? We made sure my mom didn't run away from home yesterday from the supermarket. No, what we really did, I had actually ordered like a big flour thing from FTD, but they never came.
Oh, man.
So I had to run up the street to get them. And, you know, I've been on the phone. And, you know, the way FTD works is they use a florist in your area.
Yes.
But no one can get a hold of this florist. So I had to run up the street and get something the last minute this morning.
Oh,
yeah.
So you still paid for that FTD thing?
Oh no. I talked to them and they said even if it comes tomorrow, which they said basically as of tomorrow you don't have to pay. So, you know, basically you got to follow through with this. You know, keep getting on them and make sure it's not in the credit card bill. But yeah.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, it sucks. But I was able to go. There's a great place up the street from us. My mom's place. It's called. That has a great. And they still had a lot of flowers. So I went up there and, you know, got cards and we're gonna have a barbecue tonight. But it's just aggravating. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I went and I took gifts to my mom earlier today, and then I'll come back after the show and eat with her. Because I know everyone's just curious, what is my day like with my mother? So there it is.
Oh, that's cool. That's still, that's, you know, I think we both have normal relationships with our mom. It's not like we're Norman Bates or...
Yeah. And in honor of Mother's Day, tonight we're going to be talking about Tyson.
I couldn't think of a better movie.
It's not a great segue. But,
yeah, no, that is. Well, no, it is. If you listen to our interview, though, it actually is kind of appropriate given James Toback.
You know what? It is. Yeah. You're right. You're right.
Yeah. Not with Tyson, though. No, not with him, but with Toback it is. So.
Toback, everyone knows of Mike Tyson, but anyone outside of the film realm, Toback is equally as fascinating.
Yeah.
And colorful. So this is a really interesting interview that we have. You saw Tyson, as did I, correct?
Yeah. Yes, I did. I saw it actually right before we spoke to him on Friday.
Yeah, you saw it in a sold-out theater. Tell me that experience.
Well, it's very interesting because it's just, you know, I would say 90% of the film is just him talking to the camera. And then you have some newsreel footage and you have the Robin Givens interview, but it's really all him. It's fascinating because, you know, we bring up the thing, there's no opposing viewpoint. He is his own opposing viewpoint because he is his harshest critic throughout parts of it. And
surprisingly introspective he is.
He actually is, even though they're... You know, the audience did laugh, and I laughed too. He made some obvious, mistakes, you know, referring to certain things. But for the most part, he's, you know, pretty hard on himself at certain segments of the film.
Yeah, what Toback did, I'm sure you read this, is that he didn't know how women would respond to Tyson as the subject of the film. So
right.
He took 25 women, and he said, do you have any interest in Mike Tyson? They said, no. He said, any interest in boxing? They said, no. So he said, perfect. And he had them all watch and said, if you're bored after 5 minutes, you can leave. And they stuck to the movie, and every one of them was in tears at the end of it. So they found him a very tragic kind of moving character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. He's a James Toback character. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And, of course, James Toback, great kind of legendary work. He's Academy Award nominated for writing Bugsy. As a director as well, he's directed his films Fingers, The Pickup Artist, which is that like a self-portrait, like The Pickup Artist in some respect?
I think so. The more I think about that, you know, that's a good point, especially after watching the documentary of The Outsider.
Right.
It's definitely about him. Yeah. There's no doubt about that.
Two Girls and a Guy, he really brought Robert Downey Jr. back. They had some very fruitful collaborations together. When Will I Be Loved? And then this film, Tyson, of course, is... I was about to say Knockout, and that's cheesy, but it really how do we to be corny about it? It really is. So all three of us, you and I, Jerry, and then Aaron joined in, and we each had some questions lined up for him, and so we put him in front of the movie Geek Firing Squad. And a great conversation ensued. So here you go. Here is James Toback. Enjoy it.
Mr. Toback, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I'll ask this. I'll start off. You were an asthmatic kid, and I was wondering what drew you to sports, being asthmatic as a youngster?
You know, I played tennis, and I was playing tennis at the same time as I was getting asthmatic attacks living in Florida in the winters. And Long Island in the summers, and I think it was one of the ways of compensating, you know, trying to get some semblance of athleticism and physicality into my life. And I was a kind of naturally gifted tennis player, so I persevered, even though the truth is that. I was always kind of fighting against it. That's why I was startled to hear from Mike in the movie, because I hadn't known it, even though I'd known him for 24 years, that he had these breathing problems when he was a kid.
Right.
One doesn't usually think of him as physically limited or fragile.
Mm-hmm. And when you were in the midst of the documentary process of this film, When did it occur to you that Mike Tyson fell in line with the protagonist of your other films?
Well, it actually occurred to me when I met him when he was 19.
Okay.
And I thought, this guy has so much, despite ostensible dissimilarities, he has so much that is connected to the characters I'm writing and the way I'm writing them that I could easily use him in a film. And it didn't seem like a practical thing at the moment because he was just about to become heavyweight champion, but it actually did occur to me that down the road that'd be a real possibility.
Mm-hmm. And, I remember an interview you once did with Elvis Mitchell, and you made mention of your lead characters not having much time left after the movie was over. And not having much time, you know, once the movie
right.
was over, you know, they would probably be gone in a few days or a few weeks or so forth.
Right.
And I'm curious, in regards to Tyson, is Mike surprised that he's past the age of 40, and are you surprised?
Well, he says in the movie, can't believe he reached 40.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's probably ongoingly surprised with each new year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, I certainly didn't, when I first got to know him, didn't expect him to live a long life, long being defined in his terms, not in conventional ones. And I've actually reached the age myself of 64, which is utterly insane, given that when I was 22, 23, I was promising everybody I was going to be dead at 26. And actually, when I hit my 27th birthday, I was almost embarrassed because
mm-hmm.
I thought, how do I explain this to everybody that I've been telling I was going to be dead at 26? Now that I'm old enough to be my own grandfather at 26, there's something almost comical about it.
Right. Well, would you say that I would think that starting with Two Girls and a Guy, that your protagonist kind of started to reflect this kind of cautious optimism of possibly living longer than they might have expected?
That was the only movie which I have to say I felt almost guilty about ending with what I secretly considered to be artificially constructed hopefulness. In fact, when I look at my back on my movies, that's the one that strikes me as having an egregious false note at the ending, because it really does imply that they're going to have a kind of cheerful future. And even though I'm always optimistic on some fundamental level, I secretly believe that wishful thinking, and that, as George Cukor used to call, a bad end is always around the corner. In fact, that was whenever anybody would come up to conversation, somehow Cukor would end up saying, he's going to come to a bad end, or he came to a bad end. And I finally said to him one day, why not just assume that everyone has come to a bad end, and then you don't have to bother saying it?
Well, at the end of the movie, Tyson, you dedicate it to your mother. And
you're
you've
right.
You've written probably some of the most independent-minded women in the movie. Is there a connection between the impact of your mother and the way you write women roles?
If there is, and I'm sure there is, it probably, despite 3 years of psychoanalysis, eludes me, at least consciously. But I do clearly, I feel that she, you know, was the seminal influence in my life in every way, and that everything that has happened in my life in some way revolves around the relationship that I had with her. And I look at her absence, as that quote implies, as a kind of ongoing, haunting reality.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the need to feel her presence is it's just always there with me. I look at everything else as a sort of unreal approximation of that relationship. And in fact, one of the things that I think has been at work since she died is that my own mortality, which, as I say, has always been an ongoing, has had an ongoing imminence in my mind, however long that's been, I feel that that it's 10 times truer.
Mm-hmm.
And the absurdity of being alive is an ongoing conscious awareness, which I only eliminate to a degree when I'm making a movie, because
right.
I'm thinking, well, this is a specific task at hand, and I regard it as a sort of mission. So, you know, I can actually say, well, why don't I suspend my sense of imminent mortality, even though I have not all that much control over it, for a while, until this next movie is over. And then, of course, I always hope there'll be another movie which comes to replace it in my mind, and that movie will suffice to justify continued existence.
Right. And to continue in that vein of the strong woman possibility, I got to ask, I'll ask my last question, that because I became obsessed when I heard about this biopic you've always wanted to do, and I was kind of wondering, is there any status on your Victoria Woodhull?
Well, the status is that I definitely want to do it, and the question is, who's going to finance it? I mean, the word is that it's going to be ongoingly difficult, and certainly that's been the case over the years. I think I'm going to have to get lucky. If it gets financed, which I hope it will, it'll almost be a fluke, because that is so out of step with what's being done without a real struggle. And that was true even before this economic reality came about, but certainly is truer now. And I think that the chances of its improving are slender, simply because it validates the view that movie executives have anyway, which is that it's safest to make movies for 12-year-old boys, and anything else is risky.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to hang in. I'm actually actively trying to find a way of doing it right now. I don't know in a second, but certainly over the next couple of months.
Mm. Mr. Toback, this is Jamie. I just have a couple of questions for you, and then I'll hand it over to Jerry for a couple more, and we'll let you off the hook. One of the things that I find so fascinating and endearing about you, and I guess it speaks to why you are a filmmaker, is how upfront and open you are about your demons and your ailments and so forth. And in drawing parallels between yourself and Tyson, I can see where Tyson would channel all that energy in the ring. And I'm wondering, is that this is? And you talked about this earlier. If you could expand upon it a little bit, is filmmaking that for you?
It's definitely a way of obviously not forgetting, but it's a way of sublimating the obsession with mortality, or of putting it on hold for a moment. And it's not a conscious act. But it definitely is. Anything that is absorbing, by definition, is taking hold of the mind for the moment. And that's about the only thing that succeeds that way with me.
And you mentioned psychoanalysis earlier. And there's a kind of famous quote from David Lynch on this subject where he went to a shrink and he asked the shrink, will this affect my creativity? And the shrink said, yes, it very well could. And so then he walked out because he didn't want to have any part of it. Is that a fear of yours that somehow that could have an effect?
I think that when I was in it, I was so resistant to its working on the level that the analyst wanted it to work on, that it never occurred to me that it would actually be a problem in that regard. That is to say, I didn't look at it as therapeutic or as geared to changing my life, which of course is what he did, and in changing my behavior. I looked at it as a way of getting to know myself better and finding things out that fascinated me about myself. And of course, we had an ongoing problem as a result. There was a clash of wills consistently over that difference of opinion and goal.
Let me turn you over to Jerry, and he'll come up with a couple of quick questions for you, and then we'll let you go. Jerry, you're on.
Okay, great. Mr. Toback, it is a great honor to be with you today. I just got back from a screening of Tyson, and I will let you know it was packed, and the reaction was very favorable. I have to ask this. While watching the film, I couldn't get the get it out of my mind of some of your other protagonists in your films and how much Tyson has in common with them, especially in Harvey Keitel and The Fingers and James Caan and The Gambler. And if Mike Tyson never existed, you would have had to invent him. Do you agree with that?
quite possibly. He seems to be the sort of culmination of and fruition of a number of characters that I've written about over the years, and he certainly feels, in a way, almost to be a fictional creation, as indeed I many times think I am a fictional creation of myself, or that I'm this ongoing, day-by-day created character who has an actual physical reality, but who seems to exist in some way outside the realm of reality. And it's as if I'm saying on some level, now what do I do with this person today? And I'm sort of complicit in his ongoing formation of identity, but there's somehow an unreality to it all, as there is to existence. I mean, if you think about how crazy it is that we're on this planet, you look in particular at the Hubble telescope's discoveries Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, they're fixing the Hubble again to try to give it one last run now. And I have to say, I hope they succeed, because a great deal of my awareness of not just what's out there, but what our relationship to what's out there is,
mm-hmm.
comes from the Hubble.
Oh, I agree with you 100% with that. I agree 100%. That's fascinating stuff. Now, going back to Tyson, though, I am curious, why didn't you present, like, any opposing sides, or did you think that Mike Tyson alone was more than enough, his viewpoint was more than enough for the film?
Yeah, it just struck me as superfluous.
Okay.
I mean, the idea that I would have a bunch of, well, I don't mean to be too offensive, but secondhand and ultimately lame opinions articulated just didn't interest me. I mean, to have Mike Tyson is one of the most fascinating talkers I've ever known in my life.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah.
And to take what I'm getting from him and, you know, squeeze it down so I can fit in the sort of secondhand gossip of others,
right,
would have seemed to me a catastrophic waste of movie time.
And he kind of does that in a way, too, at various points, I feel. He's sometimes, I mean, in the film, he comes across as his own worst enemy. So I
well,
think
he's
he is
certainly a very highly self-analytical and self-reflective guy. So
mm-hmm.
you're constantly getting a sort of multifaceted view of him from him.
That's true. And I think that's the thing I want to bring up, because he is a very complex character. And I think your documentary is the first to really bring about this, like, multidimensional portrait of him, whereas everything before this has really sadly been a caricature.
Yes, that's definitely true.
I wanted to actually touch on the movie Fingers, and what was your reaction? And were you approached about the remake, the French remake, the Beat That My Heart Skips?
I was approached, it was more a formality about how to get rights, and then I had one meeting with Jacques Audiard, the director.
Right.
And, I think he was just interested. He's a very kind of sly guy.
Right.
I think he was interested in getting my take and seeing how it fit into his notion and seeing if there was anything I might say that would add to what he was planning. And I felt that he did a very interesting film. It was extremely well written.
Mm-hmm.
I also felt well directed as well.
Right.
I also felt that it was, to be blunt about it, the ending was quite disappointing, because
were the two upbeat?
Yeah, because it seems that my heart skipped. I mean,
yeah.
The truth is that the movie has to end on a dark
right
note. There is no way to do it honestly any other way. And of course, he gets away free at the end. And I also, just on a rational level, don't believe that Russian gangster whom he beat would have allowed him to get away with that beating if he was allowed to survive, which he was. And I also didn't believe that he would hold a pistol to his face and start crying instead of killing him.
Right.
It's one extreme to the other.
Right.
But I mean, I actually thought it was quite a good film,
mm-hmm.
Except for that.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
I have one last question, and it's I just was curious how your Harvard education, your Ivy League days, have informed your filmmaking. I want to go one step further and say, what's a nice boy like you doing fascinated by the underbelly of life?
Well, I don't know. I always have been.
Okay,
you know,
that makes two of us. Okay, I was just curious.
Yeah, it goes back so far, and it's so deep-rooted, that it's hard to remember a time when it wasn't. It isn't like a conversion took place.
You were always fascinated by, like this life that maybe you were, that when you're growing up you read about and saw in films. Is it something like that? I mean,
it was more immediate than that. You know,
okay.
I grew up, I had an in Atlantic Beach, which is where Long Island, where you had a country house.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of Jewish and Italian gangsters and their kids. And I was quite friendly with many of them and actually mixed in that world. So it had an immediate appeal to me. It wasn't just from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, that's great.
Well, Mr. Toback, thank you so much. You've been so generous to us, and let me just say, all of us, we love you, we love your work, and you have a home on this show whenever you'd like.
Well, I appreciate that immensely, and I will take you up on it.
Okay, thank you so much, sir. Have a good day.
Thank you. Great.
Bye-bye. Okay, James Toback.
That was great.
Yeah, that was a big thrill. The movie is Tyson, and it is in limited release now. I'm sure it'll go wider as the weeks pass.
I think so.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And for those out there that, I didn't think I was interested in Mike Tyson necessarily. But what a life. What a character of contradictions,
mm-hmm.
and great demons, as we've spoken to before. And in the hands of a master filmmaker. So it really is a vivid portrait.
It is.
That is worthwhile. Okay, let's get to our next guests.
All right.
And then we'll get back to our mothers. All right. 12 in a Box is a hysterical new British comedy featuring a terrific and lively cast of colorful characters. The film won the Audience Award at the 3rd Zurich Film Festival. It's been getting raves right and left. It's a great, great funny film. For instance, Out Now gave the film 4 stars and raved, for fans of British comedy, 12 in a Box is a must. And the Godfather producer, Albert Ruddy, who we've had on the show,
mm-hmm.
claimed that it's one of the best British comedies he has ever seen. It is a really good film. And it's a great pleasure to welcome to the show tonight the film's writer-director John McKenzie, producer Bruce Windwood, and actress Belle Mary Hithersay. Let me get them on the line. I have one phone line here. Hi, Hi, this is the Movie Geeks United. How are you?
Hi, I'm John McKenzie. Yeah,
you're John. Okay, we had another phone line up, and then it just disappeared. I guess it was your cohorts. So we'll try to get them back up. But welcome. Thank you for joining us.
I managed it. I know they're trying. I know they're trying somewhere. They're
okay.
Sitting in there. Yeah, but anyway, carry on.
Well, I enjoyed the movie very much, and I'm wondering from you what your early comedic influences were, or was it particularly comedies that influenced you as a filmmaker?
I really like Woody Allen. I have to say he's always been my inspiration, because I love his fast talking style. He lets the camera run and the actors do their stuff in front of it, and he's very naturalistic. So I guess he was my early influence, if you like.
Yeah, well...
Plus, with 12 in a Box, I was influenced by the sort of 1950s, 1960s Ealing comedies, which came out of the UK.
Oh, those are wonderful.
Yeah, explain to us what characterizes the Ealing comedies.
Generally, I would say it's a collection of slightly odd, eccentric English characters who who get thrown into slightly absurd situations. But they tend to be underplayed comedies, rather different from the carry-on comedies, which tended to be slapstick. The Ealing comedies had people like Peter Sellers in, Alec Guinness, so it was a kind of understated comedy, which I tend to find very funny.
Yeah, yeah. And how did this project come about for you?
Well, in a sense, I guess I wanted to combine a project that had a touch of Woody Allen and a touch of Ealing comedy. So the idea was to do a kind of retro comedy. And we had the opportunity to film in a fantastic stately home, which if you've seen the movie, it's really magnificent. So we could build the story around the house and bring in these characters and try to recreate that Ealing comedy atmosphere.
Yeah. And was it a collaboration? Was your collaborator Bruce Winwood on from the get-go?
Yes. Essentially what we did was we thought of a rough outline idea, which was the idea of bringing some people together into some kind of reunion and then letting the situation evolve from there. And then it was my job as the writer to go off and knit the ends together and come up with the screenplay. Mm-hmm. And then obviously we'd review it together from time to time till we felt we had it right.
Yeah. And you have a great and rather large cast in this. You're following at least a dozen characters throughout the film. First of all, tell me about that casting process. Was it difficult to find the people that were not only right for the characters but right with each other?
It wasn't easy. I mean, in essence, we just had a casting which took about 4 weeks in all. We sent the script out to lots and lots of agents and described the type of people we wanted. And then when we narrowed it down through showreels and so on, they would come along and audition and read for the particular parts. Mm-hmm. And really, we went through it until we got people we felt would be okay on screen. I mean, to be honest, we didn't have the time or the luxury to then bring people together to see how they bounced off each other. So it was a matter of trying to choose the individual who'd be right for the character and then hope they would gel together as a cast on the day.
So that's a big gamble. That's like a very big gamble to take.
It is a bit, but I suppose in a sense, because the film itself, the characters come together, although they went to the same school, they were different years, so they didn't necessarily know each other particularly well. So perhaps it was less important because they had to get to know each other once they were at the big house with these situations.
Well, I guess it would benefit our listeners. I'm sorry to be so disorganized with this, but to tell them what the film is about, if you could give them a kind of a synopsis.
Okay, yeah. Essentially, 12 people are invited by email to a stately home for what they think will be a school reunion lunch, lasting maybe just a couple of hours. When they get there, a tape is played which basically says if they can stay together for 4 days, they will each get £1 million, which is about $1.5 million. But if one of them leaves the premises, nobody will get the money. And that is the setup. And, of course, people have commitments outside. One of them's getting married and so on in a couple of days. So they have to have a debate about whether they stay or go, someone to stay, someone to go.
Yeah.
They eventually decide to stay, but then all sorts of things happen that make it very difficult to stay on the premises.
Yeah. Let me see. We have a call that just came up, but it's the same number as yours.
That must be one of the other ones, because we're all in the same hotel.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Let me pick up this line. Hang on real quick. Hello, you're on. Is this Bruce or is this Belle?
I don't know. If you can hear me now, it's Bruce.
It's Bruce.
All right, it's Bruce. All right.
You sound like a Bruce instead of a Belle. Welcome to the show.
Well,
thank you very much for joining us. I was just talking to John about how much we enjoyed the film, and we're talking about the film's genesis. For you, Bruce, what was the biggest challenge in setting this film up?
For it to work, we had to get the right cast. I mean, the cast was crucial. They you know, and it had to be a cast that worked together in a credible way, particularly with in terms of Ali? I mean, there are a number of leads in the film because it is an ensemble cast, but there are particular mm-hmm. characters such as Belle's character, who plays Alice, and there's Brian and there's Ken and people like that. They had to be spot on in terms of to be able to sort of carry the film. So
yeah.
As John was saying, we had spent a long time casting to try and make sure, as far as possible, we could do it. But you never know until you turn up on set if it's absolutely going to work. So.
And John, is there a particular challenge in shooting scenes with so many characters in within the same scene?
Yeah, it's much more difficult because. First of all, they have to know where they're going to move around to. The poor DOP has to know that. And also, when you're coming in for close-ups and other angles, you have to be very on the ball with the continuity lady that they're all going to be in the right places so it edits together. So it wasn't easy at all.
Yeah, yeah. And having lived through the movie and nurtured every frame of it, when you looked at the end result, did it surprise you at all? I want to know that from both of you guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what's nice is that audiences do like it because in the end, you're so busy editing the thing and you've seen it so many times that you're absolutely buried in it. So you're not sure, well, you think, well, I like this, but will other people? But now we've seen it in front of audiences, it does seem to work, you know, so...
Yeah.
That says it for itself, really.
It is that thing about being able to see the wood from the trees, because obviously when you're involved in the actual production, and we had 10 weeks pre-production, and a fairly short schedule to get everything in the can by, when you're in all that, you have no idea. to some extent, I mean, you're relying upon the faith in the script, and
right.
your key crew, and that the actors are doing, but you don't really know. You know, there's always that fear that basically this might not all sort of thread together the way that you wanted it to in the first place. So.
Well, I would think particularly with a comedy that would be challenging to gauge after a while because you lose your perspective. And I mean, the ultimate test is showing it, as you said, in front of an audience and seeing their reaction. And the reaction has been ecstatic with all the festivals that you've played, just rave reactions from this film. Tell me about that experience, Bruce. How have you enjoyed that film festival experience?
It's been key because, once again, as I say, there's so much in terms of being a producer is a very strange job because you do get involved in a lot of things that aren't ostensibly creative, but they're necessary. I mean, I'm more of a creative producer, and I've worked very closely with John on every aspect. But you do get caught up in the whole, you know, the logistics and the financial side and everything. And once again, you do lose sight sometimes of what you're actually doing. And then when you go to a festival, it reminds you, you know, oh yeah, we've made a film and people enjoy it. You know, it's quite, you know, and without those festivals, you know, you don't get that sort of injection of confidence that what you've produced is good. I mean, the last, we came straight from Boston, the Boston International Film Festival, to LA for the US. But previous to that, we played at the Orange Open Air Festival in Zurich. It was actually on the edge of Lake Zurich, and it was astounding because it's like a huge amphitheater, and I think it's the biggest screen in the world that they actually have on pylons that go actually into the side of the lake, and it comes up, and it's sort of like the sun was setting behind it. And we managed to sell 2,000 tickets in 24 hours for that screening.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, for an independent film, you know, a non-studio film, that was an amazing experience, really. And one you can't, you want to really enjoy it while it's going on, but you can't, you know, it's also quite fleeting.
Right,
you know,
right.
After it's finished, you then go home and then you go back into all the gruel.
And John, tell me how that was for you. I mean, 2,000 tickets sold in a day, and obviously a packed house and a beautiful venue. How were you handling that? What was that experience like?
Oh, it's fantastic because, again, and the strange thing about Switzerland, of course, was it's not their first language. So you do worry a little bit that you've got German-speaking people watching a British comedy, but they really laughed. They enjoyed it. We got applause at the end. So it was quite overwhelming, the whole thing, really. And then coming to Boston after that, and also we were worried, will an American audience enjoy this film?
Right, right.
And we got the same response. I mean, it was really satisfying, and we were really pleased to get the Best Screenplay Award there. And now we've come to LA, and it's kind of repeated. So we're hoping that it's a film that all audiences can enjoy. And it's certainly a fantastic feeling when it happens. And you do have to pinch yourself afterwards.
Well, it's been a long road for the film, too, getting to the U.S. And I know you guys just had a premiere at the British Film Festival as well in L.A. Tell me about that journey. It's difficult enough to get your film made and get it in a condition that you're satisfied with. But Bruce, where does the journey go from there? What is that like?
No, I mean, you are right, because actually making the film obviously was with any independent film was very hard work. And then you have no idea. I mean, this is my first feature film, but you have no. I had no idea that was just the beginning. You know, you think you've done it, and you have done it. You've produced the film, but it's like, and, you know, you've just begun. For me, I've been, you know, every day has been a massive learning curve. I mean, for absolutely everything, and understanding the whole thing about marketing and distribution and exhibition. I mean, I actually got the film released in Switzerland, and I was the distributor, in effect, because we had an exhibitor who wanted to show it. So that was yet another hat that I had to wear, you know, and you literally just don't know. But it's you know, how that works. But then you just apply common sense, really, to most of these things. There is these things aren't a dark art. There isn't a dark art behind distribution and marketing. You know, it's hard work and talking to people and researching stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's very satisfying, but it is, you know, it is massively tiring. I mean, I'm knackered at the moment.
How many festivals are you putting this film into? I mean, a lot more than what you've mentioned. I mean, I would imagine you would try to put it in every festival available.
Yes, I mean, we've got our US distributor Cinevolt. They've put us into these two festivals. I'm not sure exactly where it's going to go from there in terms of other festivals, because it is due for a major city release in the States next up.
Mm-hmm.
So whether there'll be another festival before that, but
you tried.
But at
did
the moment,
did you do 9-1?
The aim is to actually get it out and you know maybe.
Can you
10,
find another phone to do it from? Because they want you on.
You right there, John?
Yeah. We've got Belle in here. Maybe
okay.
Actually, would you like to speak to one of the actresses? Her phone didn't work, and she's
uh-oh.
In the room with me.
We would love to speak to one of the actresses.
I'll put her on instead of me. Because now you can see a beautiful actress on the radio.
Oh, terrific. This is Belle?
Okay, I'll put Belle in there, okay?
Terrific, thank you.
Hello.
Welcome,
hi, Belle.
Hello, I'm afraid I'm a bit out of breath. I've just run from downstairs.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry that you had trouble. Welcome.
That's right.
We're pleased to have you on, and we love the movie, and I thought you were hysterical in it.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you.
We heard a little bit about the synopsis of the film, and we've been talking to Bruce and John about the mechanics of making it and distributing it.
Yeah.
Tell me about the experience of performing it, if you could tell us a little bit about your character, for those that haven't seen it.
Alice. Yeah, she's a bit of a character. She's a bit of a contradiction, because she comes across as, or she believes herself to be incredibly moral, with very, very high ethics, and yet beneath it all, she's the sort of person, she doesn't really practice what she preaches. So underneath it all, she's kind of got this need, I think, to be center stage, and I think. I think the contradictions come through in the film itself. But she's very funny. She's an absolutely wonderful character to play. And when I read the script, I knew I wanted to do the part, because she's just beautiful to play. Not an attractive part, I have to say. a nice line in cardigans, but she was brilliant fun to play. And just a dream, really, a dream role. So
So tell me, did you audition with everyone else for this film, or were you cast right out?
Okay. Yeah, I auditioned in my cardigan. I did have a pair of glasses at the time, but they didn't seem to like the glasses, but the cardigan went through. I auditioned like everyone else, and again, when I auditioned for it, you know, generally when you audition for a part, you kind of, you know, obviously you always want the part, but when you come to something like this and you're desperate for it, when you actually get the role, it's a lovely feeling. But I kind of felt it was a bit made for me, because my mother and my brother are both priests, so I was sort of brought up in a kind of church atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't live far from where it was going to be filmed, so you know, I kind of ticked all the boxes, but you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get the part. But it was it's just great to be called up for it and to be given it. So,
well, I'm curious, as an actress, you get the part, you work on it on your own, I would think, of course, but once you're put in with the rest of the group, and as we've been discussing, this is a pretty sizable cast, and you start playing off of them, how does your characterization of the part change or alter?
I think with Alice, it didn't a lot, because she kind of lived in her own world, you know. She was quite selfish in that way. So when I first read the part, she was kind of came fully formed. The performances with individual people, you change them in the respect of, you know, what's coming at you in the way of dialogue and emotion and all the rest of it. So that kind of just comes naturally and through intuition and through what the character just, you know, naturally does. But as the character itself, I think she was kind of she was fully formed from the start, and she didn't really change, but that's her character, you know. She's kind of really static in that way of, you know, she's really, what's the word I'm looking for? She's really
scary.
yeah, she's quite classic. Scary. Yeah. No, that's not the word, but yeah, that's a good one. She's got her ideals, she's got her beliefs, and she sticks to them.
Right.
And that's her, you know, no one can kind of pull her away from that. She's very kind of rigid in that way. And so that came from the beginning. And so whatever any other characters would have done, I think she would have stayed the same in that way, because she was really kind of focused of, this is my belief, this is good, this is bad, this is black, this is white, you know. So,
And I was discussing with them, when you're doing a comedy, it can be tricky, because perhaps you lose your perspective in the midst of doing it so much, whether or not it's working. So, were you confident as you were doing these scenes that it was working for you?
No, not at all. No, I mean, there are scenes where you do where it feels really right and it feels really good, and you think you know, yeah. But a lot of it, because this was the first big film I'd done, and I was quite naive about the whole thing, you know, and because I'm the sort of person, well, like a lot of actors, that absolutely hate to see themselves work, and, you know, very sort of finickety and conscious of, you know, just a perfectionist, really. And I can't remember ever seeing anything I've done that I've gone, looked at and gone, oh, that was good. And with this film, you know, many times the producer, like Bruce, would come up and say, do you want to see the rushes? And always said no, because I didn't want to see myself, because I thought it would put me off, you know, it would make me conscious of what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And now when I look back on it, there were certain things I would have done slightly differently with Alice, although I love her and she's really got a place in my heart, and you know, and I'm pleased with what I did to a certain degree, but there are certain little things I would have changed, maybe brought her down a little, maybe got her to speak a little bit slower, because she did go up, rattle off like a steam train at times. But
I think you played it beautifully. I think it's
well.
Great.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to hear, I have to say.
but you have to be satisfied from watching it with the audiences that this film has been playing.
Oh God,
in front of.
Definitely. That's been the loveliest thing, I have to say. That even surpassing the making of it, and the making of it was fantastic. But to actually sit and to hear other people genuinely really loving it. It's such a nice feeling. I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah, you can't describe it, just to be sitting in the middle of people who, you know, who don't even know you, because I don't look well, I hope I don't look a huge amount like my character. I mean, I think if you looked at me very closely, you'd tell, but at a distance, you know, we're fairly different. So, yeah, no, it's great, really great.
Well, you were wonderful in it. Bruce, I have one more question for you. What's the future of the film? Where can our listeners find it?
Well, as I was saying earlier, the plan is for it to come out in major U.S. cities soon. And then we'll
that's great.
Then we'll see where it goes from there. I mean, obviously we hope it'll then go wider in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I say we hope. I mean, we do feel very confident that people will just enjoy the film. It is
mm-hmm.
a film that you just want to go and see and have a good time. So you know, once it starts to get out there theatrically in the U.S., I think it'll go wider. It's coming out in Australia in June.
Okay.
And it looks like we're going to have a UK and possibly a German release.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, we've been concentrating very hard on the US, and that's why it's been fantastic that these two festivals have gone so well for us.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun, your film is, and it's I highly recommend it. And please contact us and give
yeah.
us updates on where the film is and so we
yeah.
can convey it to our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
It's been a tremendous treat speaking to all of you guys, and you're all welcome back anytime in the future.
Yeah, whenever you want.
Thank you.
Thank you, Val.
And good luck.
Bye.
Thank you, Bruce. Bye, bye, John. Okay, the movie is 12 in a Box. It's a great madcap British comedy. You're probably going to be hearing a lot more about this film.
It sounds like that. They're great. They're a great bunch of people. They got a lot of very charismatic, very funny. You know, very happy to be on the air. So that was great.
Yeah, yeah. It's very refreshing to have people happy to be on our show.
I think for the most part they are. I think James Toback was very happy to be on our show.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny. We went from James Toback, you know, the existential dread, to a madcap British comedy. It's great. It's great. That's who we are, man.
That's right. That's who we are. That's
all
what
right.
we're all about.
Speaking of madcap comedy or existential dread, enjoy the rest of the evening with your mothers, everyone.
I'm not going to say anything since I had such a smashing opening about that, so I spent it all there.
Exactly. Hey, what comes out this weekend? Is it Terminator?
No, Terminator's next week.
Okay.
This week it's Angels and Demons is the big release.
Oh, no wonder I forgot about it.
You know, all right, no, but in all seriousness, how many minutes do we? We have 3 minutes. No, this book, because it's actually the book is the prequel to the Da Vinci Code, even though everyone read the Da Vinci Code first.
Right.
Because that was the popular book, and then everyone went back to read his other books after that. But this is actually a better story, even though I think it is filmed the way they rewrote the script and everything is as a sequel. This story-wise is a much better story than the Da Vinci Code, so...
Mm.
I'm not a big fan of the book or the movie, The Da Vinci Code, but I think this has the potential to be somewhat more interesting.
Yeah, they've said that he goes out of his way to make it more action-packed.
Well, that anything would be an improvement. I wasn't
yeah.
crazy. I mean, I didn't think it was horrible, but I just didn't think it was worth all the hype and everything.
I mean, that's pretty much the dullest $750 million grossing movie I've ever seen in my life.
I'm not going to argue with you there, man. I'm really not going to argue with you.
All right, dude. So we're off Wednesday night.
And we'll be back next Sunday.
Yeah. The big Wednesday. So.
Oh, my God.
Was there a movie called Big Wednesday?
Yeah, the Don Milius film about surfing with Jan Michael Vincent. Great film. Yeah, I can't believe you. All right. Are you going to do a special show Wednesday? Like, is there going to be a special satellite show or something?
No show Wednesday. If I do a
show
on Wednesday, something went terribly wrong.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right.
But
so
we'll
watch,
be back
be
Sunday.
Be able to watch South Park live on on Wednesday night, folks.
Yes.
I'm going to see Star Trek again, probably. But
I'm sure South Park will be just as riddled with foul and dirty things as my Wednesday night will be. So.
Wow, that's a bold.
All right, guys. We'll see you back on Sunday for
all right,
whatever.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.